social media, in particular, social networking sites like Facebook, are making more and more personal, private, and potentially sensitive information more virtually accessible to each other, advertisers, and the government. This has been brought many concerns about the new role internet has been playing in surveillance amongst political organizers. Yet, as Tim Groves highlights in his recent article, Living Among Us, featured in Briar Patch magazine, the Canadian government has been employing a much less technologically advanced and arguably more disturbing form of surveillance on Canadian citizens. Tim Groves is a researcher and activist based in Toronto and recently published an investigative article drawing on access of information documents talking about G20 informants and infiltrators. On the heels of this publication release, Montreal activist Jaggi Singh has been served a court sentence of 60 to 90 days for his statements made publicly during G20, encouraging G20 protesters to tear down the fence separating G20 negotiations from the public. So Tim, I want to start by asking, the starting point for your article is two cases of infiltrators into political organizing in Canada that came out recently in the courts. And documents you received through access to information led you to believe this was a much more common practice than Canadian officials or even Canadian citizens might be willing to recognize. And you quote surveillance researcher Gary Kinsman as saying, "For those people who experienced this at the G20 and didn't expect it to be happening, it may have been seen as shocking or unique. But if you have a longer view of Canadian history, this is pretty standard for how the security police have related to various social movements." So I'd like you to tell me about the two infiltration cases and why you believe it's more common than just the two.
So to be clear, very little information has been released in this case, and court documents at the end of this trial will be made available, and there'll be a lot more information coming out. So what I was able to do was tell only a small part of the story, and what was told publicly by, like, released by the Crown's office and quoted in the Toronto Star was a statement that the Kate conspiracy charges that are now underway, and I think Jaggi was part of this group of co-conspirators in this case, that case was largely based on the testimony of two undercover police officers. Now, there hasn't been released yet who exactly those police officers were, or, you know, any of that information. And part of the tricky part of writing this story is that a lot of people have a lot of, you know, intelligent, educated, assumptions of who was an infiltrator and who wasn't. But those things can't be reported on as facts. So it is known that, like, you know, I was able to find people who really do think that they knew these people as infiltrators. So I spoke to, a man in Guelph who had befriended someone who, you know, has since then disappeared, and he's convinced this person was an undercover police officer who befriended him and then all of a sudden his friend wasn't who he thought it was. And he also, you know, experienced another person in his community who was far more, aggressive, trying to, get people to agree with him and saying that he wanted to do really, you know, acts of sabotage and things like that. So that's sort of like, you know, what's known is one thing. And a lot of people, you know, have a really strong sense of these people were infiltrators. And some of them may be clear and others are less clear. There may be people who have assumptions that this person was clear and it's wrong. So it's a tricky thing because the consequences, if you say, if you say someone is an infiltrator and they weren't, if they're just an innocent person who's trying to do activism and join a group, it can be really destructive to someone's life. It can stop them from getting involved in activism. And a lot of the activists, I think that activists want to grow stronger, more powerful movements that bring in all sorts of different sorts of people. And when you start, loosely saying, I think this person's an infiltrator, I think that person is, it can become really destructive to building those sorts of movements that activists are trying to do.
I think this is something that is probably like Gary says in his quote, that it could be seen as shocking or unique that there is a political infiltration happening in Canada. I wonder if you can talk about what are the laws around informants and infiltration in terms of police? What checks are there on this kind of approach to security in the country?
Well, it's my understanding that if you that there's a law that says if you expose an undercover police officer and say this person's a cop and they are, that is obstructing a police officer, so you can go to jail for saying someone is a police officer while they're still undercover. And there's also laws that came in 2002 that allow people who are undercover to, you know, be given permission from a senior official or to, on the fly, under certain circumstances, advise people to commit criminal acts in order to continue to establish their cover, in order that their cover not be blown, that they are allowed to advise people to, you know, do things that are illegal. So those are the laws that I know exist, like some of the laws I know exist to protect people who are undercover. But I'm not exactly sure what protections do exist. I believe, you know, like infiltration is used in, you know, with activist movements. There's been sometimes where the police officers have a case that they want to convict, and they use something called a Mr. Big Sting, where they invent like a sort of crime boss and pick someone and get them involved in very low-level crime, and then say, if you confess to this thing, we'll Mr. Big will, you know, make your charges go away on this other case or whatever it is, and sometimes just manipulate people into confessing to things they haven't done. So there's a lot of, you know, and that in some countries, these Mr. Big Stings are illegal, but in Canada, my understanding is that so far they've held up in court. So I know more about the laws that are there to protect people who are undercover than any that are to protect people from undercover officers.
There's clearly a big question of balance here between basic Canadian security, but then on the other side of that, as citizens, being able to trust our government, being able to trust that we're not being spied on and that we can go about our work and follow our beliefs and values without fear. And there's a question too of psychological damage or fear that can be created. Maybe you can talk about this balance and where you see Canada falling right now within the balance of trying to protect its citizens and also respecting and trusting its citizens and allowing its citizens to trust the government.
Well, the sense that I get from talking to people, and it's, again, we won't know stuff, and maybe they'll never, like, not all the, if only two infiltrators are giving testimony, we may never get the full picture of what happened in the G20. But there's a lot of people who joined activist groups and then disappeared, joined them in a certain time before, like, the G20 protests, and then, you know, somewhat, like, just before the protests or just after the protests, left and haven't been heard from since, and that people have sort of, you know, thought these people may be infiltrators, can't track them down, can't find their family, can't, you know, find any trace of them. So if those are all true, the net was cast very, very wide for this G. Kenning case. It wasn't that people who were, you know, doing the most, you know, like, militant rhetoric of saying we're going to, you know, like, I think Jaggi, you know, was, you know, he was, his charges were for saying we're going to take down the fence. But it wasn't just people who were saying we were going to take down the fence who were being infiltrated. It's people who were like, we want to go out on the streets and provide medical aid to people who are being hurt, or we want to, you know, be legal observers to make sure that the police don't overstep their bounds, or we want to provide, you know, alternative media on the street. So if those are all true, and we don't know yet if they are, the net was cast quite wide. And I think part of the problem is that the intelligence, that gathering that goes on for events like the G20, they start to look and they see, I don't think they, like, I'm looking through various intelligence documents, I think they start to see people who have, you know, views that are counter to the status quo, and they start to see all of them as dangerous. in all of them as having this sort of, and you start seeing, like, sometimes, you know, this is definitely happening in the States, where people who are doing, you know, activism that, you know, can be labeled as terrorists. In the U.S., there's nonviolent peace activists who have been labeled as terrorists. And this, you know, this sort of, like, a lot of times these agencies have been put in place to do intelligence gathering on terrorism, and there's mission crawl. There's the fact that, well, there isn't a lot of terrorism that's actually happening. It's more rhetoric than actual terrorism, so you have to spread the net further and say, well, maybe these people can be called terrorists, or these people, and soon it's people who, you know, like, it's a trick, slippery slope, and it wouldn't, you know, it's really not that far-fetched that anyone, no matter what they do, or, you know, as long as they're, you know, posing some sort of, you know, counter view to the status quo, could be, you know, given these labels. And then once you've given that sort of, you know, the dangerous label or the terrorist label or whatever, it's very easy to justify doing the sort of surveillance. So I don't have a lot of, you know, I think there is a matter of resources. It's, these operations are intensive. You have people who are living for, you know, months and years undercover. You have all their handlers. It's not a small thing. So they don't always have the resources to do this, and it's much easier for the police to try and find disillusioned activists and try and, you know, convince them to become informants, manipulate them, or, you know, entice them in various ways. That's much more, you know, financially feasible thing. But it doesn't, I don't think there's anything that's stopping these days the police in Canada from trying to put infiltrators in groups far and wide. And it's shrouded in secrecy, so the public, you know, public doesn't know, and there, it's very hard to, you know, the public might react really strongly if all of the information was out there. But what I'm reporting on is this the tip of the iceberg? Is this the whole thing? Have I, you know, taken some? Are some of these rumors that people are talking about not true? Like, we don't know, because the nature of an undercover operation is that it's shrouded in secrecy, and, you know, some of the protections that, you know, if this sort of undercover work is going to continue, some of the protections that could exist is that after a certain amount of time, it should be disclosed publicly. But I don't think that there's a movement right now or pressure in Canada that there's going to be any sort of, you know, safeguards. Well, there's movements, but I don't see the government implementing a lot of safeguards at this point, and that some of these abuses that have happened are really exposed.
With the Harper government being reelected, and this time not as a minority government, what do you see that meaning for political opposition, grassroots organizing? I guess especially seeing that the G20 and for the Vancouver Olympics, it was some of the largest police mobilizations that we've seen in Canada.
You know, I'm not convinced that the scale or of the operations that were going on during the G20 are still going on today. Now, there's definitely a lot of disagreement on this stuff, but, like, my sense is that the sort of fear of infiltration, the sort of, you know, sense that everyone is looking behind, you know, every mailbox to see if there's an undercover officer, or questioning their friends, and this sort of, like, the mistrust that's generated, the paranoia. These things also lead to divisions in groups, and it that stuff, I think, is far more destructive at this point than there being infiltrators in groups. Now, I don't think anyone should. I think one of the points of the article is that this does happen, and you never know. So it could be happening now, but, you know, I think the G20 and the Olympics were sort of special events where a lot of resources were harnessed. There might be local police forces that would be infiltrating groups anyway, or there might be other operations that are going on. But I do think the G20 had a sort of special place where the amount of budget that was, you know, could be harnessed to do this was much, much greater, so that you could have, you know, dozens of, well, like, in my document suggests there were 12 infiltrators, and there could have been more. So during the G20. Now, whether they have the resources to do that all the time, I doubt it. But that doesn't mean that people should, you know, assume that it isn't happening either. Now, I do think with the Harper government in power now, if the if there is a big security, you know, push for something, whether it's, you know, more security on First Nations movement protests and movements, or it's more security on whatever is, you know, I think that, you know, security police in this climate are going to have a much easier time harnessing resources. So this could easily happen again and be replicated.
My last question for you comes off of the what you're talking about, given the destructive nature of not necessarily even having infiltrators actually in groups, but just the idea they can be there. And in your article, there you present two opposing views on how to best deal, or two different views on how to best deal with infiltration. So what do you take from these answers? What would you recommend as a course of action?
I mean, I think it's always important to, like, analyze the risks that are in place. Like, is it worth, like, what are the actual possible things that could be happening? And sometimes, you talked about Facebook. Like, what are the risks from, you know, how I'm doing? And can I put in measures to, you know, protect myself? So maybe it's making your Facebook, you know, friends private. Is that doesn't take a lot of work. But if you're going to do, you know, full out like background checks and spend like a day researching each person who wants to join your group, that's going to take a lot of energy out of your organization and stop you from being able to function in a way. So, you know, depending on what you're doing, if you're doing open public organizing, and like, you know, as most activists are, you maybe you don't have the energy to spend a day researching each person and doing their background. So you got to weigh the pros and cons of what's going on. There's definitely, like, you know, like one of the views that was expressed in the article is that people should start looking for, you know, ways to get to know the people that that they work with better, and getting to know, you know, what is their history. And and, you know, like another view that was expressed is that, like, the best way to fight the impacts of infiltration is to try and build strong, united movements that focus on their strengths. So being really democratic and dealing, rather than trying to create like internal police forces that seek out this stuff, building strong, open movements will mean that when divisions do come up, people can deal with them in open ways. And those sorts of, like, the mistrust that can be generated of this stuff can be dissipated, because everything's on the table and people are, you know, finding ways to work well and, you know, building strong movements. So, you know, no matter what, whether it's something, a problem that's created by the state, or a problem that's created, you know, internally, or something else that's going on, some other crisis, that people find, you know, good ways of dealing with that and have built those structures to handle that stuff. I think that would be, that's one of the ideas of how to, you know, build movements that aren't as easily, prevented from their goals by infiltration or other forms of state intervention.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, no worries. Thank you.
I just spoke with Tim Groves, an activist and researcher based in Toronto, about his recent article, Living Among Us, published in Briar Patch magazine. If you'd like to actually read the article and find out more about what Tim talked to me today about, you can go to briarpatchmagazine.com/articles/view/living-among-us. Or if you search Tim Groves in Briar Patch, I'm sure you'll find it.